Live from Chicago, this is Dan Proff sitting in for Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, you, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications Radio Studio in Chicago's beautiful River North area. Tonight, we're featuring commentary from Democrat John McCarron, a contributing columnist at the Chicago Tribune and a lecturer at DePaul University. Charles Lipsum, straight from Marks, Mississippi, a political science professor at the University of Chicago. And Pat Hughes, who ran in the Republican primary for the U.S. Senate here in Illinois last year. He is currently the vice president and general counsel at Ocean Atlantic Realty. Our toll-free phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. I've been a frequent guest on Beyond the Beltway. Happy to be embarking on my maiden voyage as a guest host for Bruce Dumont, who I think is at the TV Land Awards. This is what, you know, high-powered media types get to do on the weekends.
I had a question because you're the moderator. Does that mean you're going to be moderate tonight, Dan?
John McCarron already trying to set the ground rules, marshal control of the show. I am. I'm going to be the interrogator, if you will, but not in a rendition
we'll
sight of way.
Tonight,
yes.
The seas begin to recede.
Yes. Well, obviously, the big story of the week and into the weekend was the government shutdown that was averted literally at the 11th hour on Friday night. That's been the talk that's dominated the weekend, and it's now framing the conversation in Washington, D.C. with the proposal that Paul Ryan has on the table, and with the president we hear today from David Plouffe, prepared to make a address to the nation on Wednesday evening about his views on what entitlement reform should or shouldn't look like. So let's start with John McCarron, since you broke the seal. Your views on how the president and the Democrats fared in the government shutdown that was averted.
Well, the president obviously thinks he fared pretty well. He was all chipper morning after and went running up to the Lincoln Memorial and announced that the Lincoln Memorial is still open. Democrat, progressive, but a pragmatic one, I'm not all that happy because he obviously and his leadership team on the Hill obviously caved on a number of things. As a journalism professor, I got to have a little side rant here, though, that we don't really know what he caved on because there hasn't been a lot of specific information coming forth on the weekend newspapers and whatnot about what exactly $70-80 billion of cuts, what they came out of. You know, we have little dribs here and little dribs there, but it looks to me like he gave up on some important things, like part of his health care package that I know you want to call Obamacare. Has been sacrificed, I think, a couple of billion dollars to set up these cooperatives, for instance. So there's something that I think is important to liberal Democrats that our leader has compromised away.
Charles Lipsum, how does what transpired on Friday night and the deal that was struck, how does that inform the forthcoming battles, not just over entitlement reform, which is going to be a biggie, but even over the raising of the debt ceiling, which may be coming in the next 4 to 6 weeks?
I think what you see is that Paul Ryan and the Republicans more generally have emerged as the lead dog in this pack. They're driving the debate, which is really amazing. And it's not just that they're driving debate in the short term. It's that they have driven the debate away from the initial proposals when the president came in his first 2 years' budgets were really substantial increases in the role of the federal government and the size of federal budgets. The proposals that came out a couple of weeks ago that were the Democratic proposals were essentially stay flat, give up zero. And what ended up is the first time in modern history that the government's budget has been cut in real terms. I think that sets the game on Republican terms. I do think that they hurt themselves to some extent by raising a number of non-fiscal issues in the final negotiations. It turns out those were ciphers. They were simply bargaining chips. Boehner gave them up in order to get bigger cuts. But those are much more contentious publicly, what you do about abortion and all the rest. I think they're on strong ground when they're on fiscal ground.
Pat Hughes, both sides on Friday night, in terms of their spin, their declaration of victory, talked about historic spending cuts. Senate Majority Leader Reid said that. Speaker Boehner said that. The president said that. A lot of Tea Party folks and the kind of energized base of the Republican Party make the point that historic spending cuts after historic spending levels, and that the context is important. Michelle Bachmann tweeted the day after the deal on Saturday morning that she would vote no, that this was not a deal that was acceptable to her, potentially echoing the feelings of a lot of Tea Partiers. Where do you see that coming down with the kind of the Tea Party grassroots of the Republican Party? And do you think this was a good deal, or this was a hill that the speaker should have died on?
It certainly was a better deal for the Republicans than for President Obama. I mean, as Charles mentioned, he started off with a budget proposal that laid flat, and then they moved it up to a $5 billion cut, then a $10 billion cut, and now I think we're at $38.5 billion. So John Boehner and Paul Ryan won this clearly. How that will impact folks on the Tea Party level, I think, remains to be seen. Certainly, the Tea Party folks were looking for larger cuts, $60 billion, $65 billion, and I know that's why Representative Bachmann and others are upset about it. The real issue here is that we're talking about small amounts, even in a year-to-year budget in terms of the cuts. And what Representative Ryan is going to address on Tuesday, and what we need to focus on, I'm sure you'll get to as we progress in the show, is the structural long-term debts and deficits that we face because of the entitlement spending that is not discretionary.
It spoke volumes. It spoke volumes that Nancy Pelosi was at Tufts University in Boston when the real deals were coming down. That is, the spenders, the left wing of the Democratic Party and the progressives really were totally outmaneuvered. And I would say not because of clever negotiations, but because of the November elections.
What about the president's positioning here? And this is open to anybody. The president certainly took a low profile as the contentiousness was occurring between the two parties and the back and forth as the deadline loomed, and then emerged after the deal had been cut kind of to cast himself, I think, in the role as kind of the great conciliator, somebody who makes compromises now because maybe he has to as opposed to he wants to. How did the president specifically come off on this, particularly, and is the way he is treating this any indication of what we can see as the 2012 reelection ramps up? John McCarron?
Well, it depends how deeply you want to look at it. If you're the kind of person that just gets their, the top of the news kind of thing before you head for the sports or who won the Masters, then you probably think he came out okay because he's running up to the Lincoln Memorial. And as you said, he got his hands dirty just in the last 48 hours of this thing. He sent Joe Biden in, I think, to do some of the hard negotiating toward the end, or at least to be in the room when the hard negotiating was going on. But as I said earlier, if you're really into this sort of thing, program for program, and you're looking that he's given up on health care programs, on housing assistance programs, $13 billion cut from the Departments of Labor, Education, and Health and Human Services. If you're a true liberal, you're not too happy right now.
We're going to take your calls and pick up on this conversation, get to the issue of entitlement reform, 1-800-723-8289 on Beyond the Beltway after this. Dan Proft back with you, sitting in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway. For those of you who don't know me, I am a talk show host on the WLS radio network in Chicago, and ran for governor of Illinois unsuccessfully, of course, in the 2010 cycle. Joined by John McCarron from Chicago Tribune and DePaul University, Charles Lipson from University of Chicago, a distinguished professor, Pat Hughes, who also ran for office. He was a Republican candidate for U.S. Senate in the 2010 cycle. We're talking about the averted government shutdown and the political fallout from that, who won, who lost, who looked good, what's the positioning, and what does this foretell us about the 2012 cycle. And, Pat, you wanted to make a point about what you thought how you thought Obama came off on this.
Well, I don't think he came off well. And your question previously that John had answered related to, you know, why did he wait? Why does he come in the last 48 hours and then, you know, run up the steps and claim victory? And I think it's more indicative of who he is as a person and as a leader, which I think is extremely ineffective. And this was an example of that. He was trying to see where the issue was going. He didn't lead on it at all, as, you know, and I'm sure Democrats must be very, very frustrated, particularly liberal Democrats, with respect to that. And it shows that he's weak. You know, he was a little weak on some foreign policy issues that led up to this in the last month, and he was weak on this. And I think it portends why his poll numbers are where they're at. And the Republicans, if they have a good candidate, have a real shot at knocking him out in 12.
Just a follow-up to that, Pat. The messaging of the Republican Party, Speaker Boehner, you know, making the case kind of sort of that, hey, the Democrats could have passed a budget, you know, for 7 months and they didn't do it. They kicked the can to us. We were elected in November with a mandate to cut spending, and this is what we're trying to do. How is John Boehner coming off as a Republican leader? And do you see lessons learned from the Gingrich era the last time we were at this point?
Well, when we were off the air for a second, Charles made a great point about the difference between Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner.
So you're going to steal it?
I'm not going to steal it. I'm going to let him do that, but I'm going to say there's a difference between what John Boehner is doing now and maybe what Gingrich did back in the 90s.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Boehner is being very effective. He's looking at all sides of the issue. He's coming off very, very well. He's keeping his conservative base in place, even though they're not going to be absolutely happy, which is the struggle that a speaker has to go through. So I think overall he's done a very good job. I think it is a very good point that the Democrats did kick the budget issue down the road. That's what they're doing because they don't know what to do right now. They're at a loss. Their leader is the President of the United States. He's very unpopular, and it's getting worse, and he's not showing leadership. So they're scrambling a little bit.
Charles?
Several points. One is that I think it would have been a disaster for the Republicans if the government had shut down, because I think that the sense that we send people to Washington to get things done and now we've kind of got a disaster, and especially if it had been perceived as over non-fiscal issues. Second point is that I think Boehner is doing a good job with his caucus. And what Pelosi did was she forced on a number of issues, she forced her moderates, a lot of them from southern and swing states, to take very tough votes on issues like Obamacare. They won by a few votes on those, but all those people who cast those votes are now unemployed. So the swing votes that she pushed hard, Boehner didn't do that. I think it's quite up in the air about how President Obama comes out of this. Pat may be right, but there's another way of looking at it. It's true that he doesn't look like a strong leader in the sense that the budget battles are now seem to be driven by the Republicans, and Republicans who don't look so ideological look like real adults. Paul Ryan is exactly the right face. But I've got to say, the way that President Obama wins re-election is if he appears to be a kind of moderate who can pull in swing voters. And he does come out of this looking as a person who wants to move forward for the country as a whole. That's how he spun it. I think that that's ultimately his winning strategy.
And John McCarron, you were making the point before the break that this is certainly a reach to independents and moderates, and that seems to be the tone the president is taking and the tack that he has made.
He is the great conciliator, the great kumbaya compromiser, and he thinks that that's a winning strategy. I think politics is the art of the attack. And right now the Republicans are on the attack, claiming that the Democrats have created this terrible budget deficit, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a winning program. And they're also attacking public employee unions. That's also a winning program because they've created jealousy among people who aren't in unions, thinking that the problem are public employees. I mean, attack politics is what works. And on the Democratic side, you have someone who's still trying to get us all together so we can work out our differences, et cetera, et cetera. I just don't think it's effective
politics.
Can I ask
a question to you, John?
Yeah, go ahead.
Don't you think that the problem with attack politics ultimately is that you can overreach? How would the Republicans, what is the danger to them in terms of overreaching?
It is a danger, and I guess that's now our best hope, really, going into the next presidential round. because we're obviously not going to attack. We're not going to, you know, go after Wall Street or the, you know, the mortgage banking industry.
So out of that hope and change, it's all the change part's gone. Huh?
But you're right on the overreaching. For instance, I thought it was really dumb of the Republicans to go after Planned Parenthood at the end, and because poll after poll has shown. And I'm just talking politics. I'm going to want to. I saw that driving into the station parking lot tonight that Dan is carrying Choose Life license plate holders and yes. on his car. So I don't want to move the discussion in that direction. But it's just a losing issue politically. It has been historically for the Republican Party, that and some of the other so-called social issues.
I'm going to have to disagree with Janet. First of all, I don't think it's a losing issue at all. I think it hasn't been advocated the appropriate way. But in this instance, it was more of a very important piece of the negotiation. And I think that the Republicans were very smart to use it. What it does, whenever this topic comes up, it inflames the far left base of the Democratic Party to look very angry, very childish, which they typically come off as being.
Like the union folks in Madison, Wisconsin.
And they did that then, and they did it in Wisconsin. So politically, it's a very smart move. And then at the end, it got taken off. But the base knows, and I'm a member of the base and represent the base. The base knows that Boehner and the others were negotiating that point for them, and maybe we'll get it down the road. And it was a very well-played strategic decision by them to get something done.
I view the conservatives as having three main groups today in America. One is a group of fiscal conservatives. That's their main issue. The other is a group of social conservatives, so abortion, number of other social issues, gay marriage. And the third are people who are foreign policy conservatives, neoconservatives, and so forth. You can't win on foreign policy issues no matter what. Foreign policy never drives the election. Even in World War II, it hardly drives the election. Social conservatives seem to be able to get 40% of the vote in big elections. I know that a lot of these groups overlap, but where the Republicans have become a majority in the current environment is on fiscal issues. And to the extent that they muddy that water, I think it hurts them. By fiscal issues, I mean two things. The federal budget and the trajectory of the economy, and the president has had trouble on both. Basically, he expanded the budget very rapidly, ran very large deficits, and put in a big stimulus on top of substantial increases. I think that the public's response to this is that for all of those programs had very modest impact on the economy given the cost, and we will be paying that cost for a long time. Those are strong issues for the Republicans to run on. I think the social issues are exactly what, or birth of the birth certificate or something like that, exactly what the president would love.
Yeah, and Donald Trump is helping him on that. Before we leave this and go to entitlement reform and the Paul Ryan proposal, let's take a call. We've got Steve in Myrtle Beach from WRNN. Who's got a comment on this averted government shutdown. Hey, Steve.
Hey, panel. How you doing? I'm a conservative in South Carolina on all three platforms you just brought up, as a matter of fact.
Triple threat.
The thing that interests me the most about the shutdown was that the first thing that came out of Harry Reid's mouth was the draconian measures that we've had a 25% increase in spending, and we're only looking at roughly a 2% cut. One of the signs that I saw on the internet was, please keep Boehner out of my private area, my private parts, as if this 2% was going to just take everything away from the liberals. And I would love for somebody on the left side to please explain to me how 2% can be so draconian.
I think he's referring to you, John.
Yeah, I say, well, you know, I watched a lot of C-SPAN when the Republicans took over the House, and they were coming up with their riders, and they were going after everything. I mean, they were not only were they going after abortion, you know, they were going after they're going for prayer in the schools and all this, the usual list of let's defund the United Nations, the foreign aid and whatnot. It was, you're from South Carolina. Maybe that's music to your ears, but up here in the land of Lincoln, you know, that it was kind of scary stuff. Boehner probably did a good job to tone it down to the point that he,
that he did. And as far as, you know, Professor Lipsum is right that the Democrats have allowed themselves to be blamed for all this spending that's been necessary since the Republicans ran the economy into the ditch. And without ever explaining that this had to be done. Oh, they try to explain, but I mean, when you instead of sending the Justice Department out to find out who actually caused this mess, you know, they've got them poking around some arcane insider trading scandal or something like that. To me, that's just not winning winning government. It's not winning politics.
But John, are there spending cuts that you, as a liberal or that progressive, say, you know, this is an area where
we
should
cut? Oh, you betcha. You betcha.
Give me an example.
I think especially, and I think we ought to talk about this tonight, healthcare, Medicaid and Medicare have got to be reined in. Where does that money go? Here's some news. It doesn't go to poor, sick people. It ends up going to the pharmaceutical industry, to people who make radiology equipment, et cetera, et cetera.
And
cuts could be made there.
We'll talk more about that. Take your calls, 1-800-723-8289 here on Beyond the Beltway. Dan Proft filling in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway. Back with you, my guests. John McCarron from the Chicago Tribune, Charles Lipsum from the University of Chicago, Pat Hughes, a real estate attorney and former Republican candidate for U.S. Senate. Pat, you wanted to pick up on a comment that John McCarron had made before the break?
It was actually one that Charles made. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to do that. Regarding the three parts of the Republican Party and the philosophy that it's important that fiscal issues be kept front and center and the social issues be put in the back. I think that's an effective strategy currently because of the economic mess we're in. But Republicans have to be very careful in doing that. It is important that we not just be a party of fiscal issues because over time that won't serve us well. There are a lot of social conservatives in our party. I'm one of them that helped drive the vote, helped drive the support, and we have to be very, very careful not to become just a one-note party in that respect.
I think that there's a lot to that. I'm just speaking of this as an analyst, not as a protagonist, but I would say that they've got another danger, and that is that if they look to be the party only of cutting the budget and don't have a jobs growth agenda, they'll also have a potential problem. The president is in a weak position because it's obvious that the sort of Keynesian stimulus programs didn't work as well as they had projected them to do. So the Republicans have an opportunity, but the very things that make it hard for the Democrats to advance larger government expenditures make it hard for Republicans to talk about tax cuts of any significant degree that will allow them to stimulate the economy. So it's going to be everybody wants to get back on the Republican side to the sweet spot that Ronald Reagan had, and it's going to be hard to do that.
Well, let's speaking of shark-infested waters, let's turn to the Paul Ryan plan. And my question to the panel is, Paul Ryan is receiving a lot of plaudits from a lot of circles, including left-center circles, for advancing what some believe is a very serious, and I'm one of them, a very serious proposal for entitlement reform, maybe with the exception of Paul Krugman, who thinks it's ludicrous and cruel. We can talk about Paul Krugman and maybe John McCarron, too, but certainly he has been given a lot of credit for courage in touching what a lot of people believe is the third rail. But is this a Jerry Maguire moment for Paul Ryan, which is he writes the manifesto and everybody applauds when he comes out of the elevator, and privately they're all whispering to themselves saying, this guy's going to be out in a week. He hasn't got a lot of House co-sponsors, although many of the Republican presidential candidates have signed on in principle. You know, is this the kind of courageous leadership? Is this going to be courageous leadership from the Republican Party that buoys them into the 2012 cycle? Or is this going to be something the Democrats can tackle and feast on and capitalize on politically? Pat Hughes.
Well, you know, Dan, as you know, I went to college at Marquette University, and there must be something in the water up in Wisconsin, because Scott Walker and Paul Ryan are politicians who say they're going to do something that is important, that will structurally change an unsustainable circumstance, and they go ahead and they do it. Now, does that have political consequences? I think we're going to see that potentially it does, because not every person on either side of the aisle is as courageous or principled as those two appear to be. I hope that's the case. I hope that they get the support that they need, because something needs to be done. with the structural non-discretionary spending, or this is unsustainable. It won't matter what we do on anything else because we will go completely bankrupt. And some of the other issues that we have the luxury of talking about tonight or other times will become meaningless because our country will fail to operate in the way it needs to. So I applaud Ryan for doing it. I hope he gets some support. We need to see exactly all the details of the plan. But this is the type of leadership, his leadership, Walker's leadership, that I think is important. This is what the voters asked for, and these guys are at least trying to deliver it.
But Charles, there's a lot of policy wonks and academics and people who follow this stuff very closely give him credit because entitlements are insolvent. Medicare is insolvent. So something has to be done. And everybody nods their head when politicians say something has to be done. But then when they hear that the something may be ending Medicare as we know it, as the Democrat talking point seems to be, then seniors start to get a little nervous and they start to maybe flock away from the Republican Party. What's your view on the Ryan proposal and the tone of this debate currently?
I think we don't know enough about the details, and we're going to learn a lot more as the debate moves forward. The sort of cut and response, the thrust and response over the next few months, actually. I don't think this is something – I think this is one of the biggest domestic political issues that we've faced since the civil rights battles of the 60s. I mean, I think that this is a basic issue, not only about solvency of the country going forward.
Because it's because of the intergenerational nature of it?
There's an intergenerational nature, and there has been a gradual and growing role of the federal government that's never been debated as such. Let me give you an example. During the oil crisis of the mid-1970s, United States government forced the state of Massachusetts – I was living in Massachusetts to undergraduate school at the time – forced the state of Massachusetts to institute right on red for – you could turn right on red. Well, cars in Massachusetts – run into each other constantly. I've never seen driving.
That's usually the Kennedys driving.
Well, that too. It's just awful. And anything you can add to the confusion was a problem. So local legislators, in their wisdom, had said, no right on red. You know, it's tough enough for people to stop at red. Okay? And the federal government said, no, we've got to change that. When we talk about a government of limited and defined powers with state and local governments having an important role versus the federal government intervening at the level of local traffic laws, speed limits which come up, and local traffic laws, that's a big debate. So it's not just a debate about the level of federal spending. I think it's a debate about the role that the federal government should play, whether or not the social safety net should be tailored so that it's really a safety net for the poorest, or whether the government should be providing support for public radio for people in Volvos to listen to, and so, or whether that should be paid for, as it mostly is now, by private donations. I mean, you know, what's the role of the federal government? So I think we've got two big issues. One is the size of the federal budget, and the other is, I think, the role of Washington relative to state and local governments.
John, I want to read something that Paul Krugman wrote and see if you can help me decipher it. I don't pretend to understand what he talks about usually. Yeah, he says, and this is in a critique he had in the New York Times of the Paul Ryan plan, which, as I said, he termed it ludicrous and cruel. He's talking about the specific proposal in the Ryan plan, which would provide premium supports for Medicare coverage, and then seniors would make the choice of which provider that they would get their coverage from. This is Krugman writing. He says, the point here is that privatizing Medicare does nothing in itself to limit health care costs.
True.
In fact, it almost surely raises them by adding a layer of middlemen. Now, if the government is removed from the process except to provide essentially a voucher for you to choose the coverage of your choice. How is that added? Isn't that subtracting a layer of middleman?
Well, it would be. If you would allow there to be a public option under the Paul Ryan plan, I would say that would be a possibility to do some good. A Chevrolet-grade insurance plan that doesn't provide for some things,
that the high end plan does, then it might work. But what Ryan is calling for is essentially vouchering out Medicare and block granting Medicaid to the states, and then ratcheting down the global numbers. The thing is that if you give somebody $18,000 and tell them, here's your $18,000 voucher, go buy some health insurance. What if the cost of pills and of medical devices and of radiology, et cetera, that the industry seems to be developing and pushing up the price of constantly? I mean, what good does that $18,000 do you if if even a bare bones healthcare policy is going to cost $30,000 or $40,000?
I think the problem that they had on healthcare is that not only is the current arrangement, the Obamacare arrangement or whatever you want to call it, very complicated. There's nothing in it that bends the cost curve.
I agree.
And the idea here is to put pressure by essentially letting consumers play a larger role.
You guys have the boards lighting up, so let's take Pat from Plainfield, Illinois, on our flagship station, WLS.
Hi. Thank you for getting me on. I've got three very quick comments, and then you guys can answer them. First of all, concerning Medicare and Medicaid, exactly. That should have been corrected and put to bed before you ever passed another law. The fraud, the corruption, that should have been done. Second, concerning Obama getting reelected, if the Republicans can get anyone that can speak and articulate properly, this guy will never be reelected. And thirdly, the condescending comment that gentleman from, I have to call him a gentleman from Illinois, made to that gentleman in South Carolina, like we in Illinois have something to be proud of in a corrupt state like this with his bankrupt. You've got some guts coming off saying that. So, gentlemen, I listen to your show. I'd like to hear your comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. John McCarron, you've got some guts.
Uh-oh. I'm on the carpet.
You're on the hot seat again.
What would he like me to? What would he like me to respond to? Does he want an apology for?
I think what
South Carolina first in the Confederacy. Right?
I think what he's saying is something that I took when you made the comment too, that there was something more sophisticated about us up here in Illinois, and that's why the things that some of the Republicans were talking about would rub us the wrong way up here. And you know, that's what I think he's reacting to, and I think we get a lot of that from the liberal left, sort of this idea that the great unwashed that comes from South Carolina or anywhere in between is not sophisticated enough. So that's where I think he's coming from.
Well, and Charles Lipson is actually from the South, so we'll get his.
I need to wash. We'll need to wash soon.
We'll hear from the one guy from south of the Mason-Dixon line after the break. Dan Prof filling in for Bruce Dumont. Beyond the Beltway, we'll be back with more of your calls. Dan Prof filling in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway this evening. Back with our panel of power brokers and pundits and professors and political insiders and all that good stuff. Taking your calls, 1-800-723-8289, discussing the Paul Ryan proposal, his Path to Prosperity proposal. He was on Meet the Press this morning, holding court with David Gregory on the proposal. But also now, again, to the point, Charles, you made earlier in the hour that Republicans are kind of driving the debate and have changed the conversation on spending and entitlements. The president is going to speak to the nation this coming Wednesday on entitlement reform. What do you expect him to say?
I expect him to make a much more – first of all, I expect him to move toward actual cuts and to say that going beyond what he wants to do would be draconian. It would affect the weakest, the poorest, and so forth. But I think that just as – for about 40 or 50 years, we really lived in the FDR coalition. And even if you were Dwight Eisenhower or Richard Nixon, you were governing within basically a Democratic majority coalition. I think that what we see is that when Obama tried to move out of essentially centrist Reagan-right country, that is center-right country, with large government budgets and a real shift. The hope and change was a vague promise, but when he implemented it, it was a lot more government spending and so forth, that he's been moved off of that. If you look at really what's happening, the hope and change mantra, the Democrats are now increasingly the party of status quo. It's the Republicans who are arguing change. And I think the challenge for the Republicans is to say, look, the change that we're talking about will prevent bankruptcy and ensure that you get the safety net going forward. If the Democrat, and what the Democrats want to say is they are cutting holes in the basic safety right. net and people will fall through.
And Pat, David Plouffe, as I referenced earlier in the hour, was on the Sunday talkies as well, maybe telegraphing some of what the president is going to have to say. Specifically, he reminded the viewers that still doesn't favor the extension of the Bush tax cuts to that wealthy top 2%. Do you expect his remarks on Wednesday to be policy-oriented in terms of going tit-for-tat with Paul Ryan or more posturing for 2012?
I doubt it'll be going tit-for-tat for Paul Ryan because every time the president of the United States has an opportunity to address the nation, it's politics, particularly with the election coming up in 2012. He has the bully pulpit. I suspect that he feels a little bit wounded after this budget negotiation and what Ryan's going to come up with earlier in the week. So I think it's going to be politics, and I think he's going to do a little bit of what Charles said. I think he's going to take a little bit of the fight to the Republicans, tell his base and the middle that the Republicans' plan is going to, you know, put people out of work, is going to take away their rights that they've paid into for many, many years, and it's going to be more politics. And quite frankly, if I was advising the president, that's exactly what I would advise him to do, because it's time for him to do that, because he is extraordinarily weak. And if he doesn't come out swinging a little bit, he's just going to appear weaker and weaker as it progresses.
And John, as a liberal, you're disappointed, you mentioned early in the hour, with the deal and some of the spending cuts that may be included in this $38 billion deal that was struck on Friday night. What do you hope to hear from the president on this issue on Wednesday night?
Well, you didn't let me get a chance early to praise Paul Ryan, and I wanted to do that because politically I thought it was very astute. The whole country is thinking budget, but everybody's thinking, you know, the run out of the fiscal 11. And here comes this guy from Wisconsin who doesn't have that high a national profile with a 10-year plan, which I thought was brilliant on his part and his handlers. So I think President Obama is going to counter, and it's going to maybe have elements from the so-called the Gang of Six, the bipartisan
the Fiscal Commission,
and the Gang of Six, and Alice Rivlin and whatnot, and it's going to be the president's 10-year plan to tame, not do away with, but tame the deficit, get it down to a more reasonable proportion of the gross domestic product.
Do you think he, this Charles Lipson, did he make a mistake, John, in not running with the deficit commission earlier, putting pressure on his people to vote for it and so forth? They let that die.
They did. I mean, I think this is a president that likes to wet his finger and put it in the air and see which way the wind is blowing and what will work in terms of people's response to a fault.
I think there's a moment for conciliation here. Before we get too comfortable with one another, let's go to another friend in the listening audience. Let's go to Eric, who is joining us from Austin, Texas on KLBJ. Hey, Eric.
Hello, fellas. How we doing today?
Good.
So I keep hearing this phrase about unsustainability of Medicare, Medicaid, and unsustainability of these workers' unions in these states and whatnot. But, you know, I posit an idea that doesn't seem to get much traction in our media today, and that is the unsustainability of our economy in general. That is to say, the working class, the rank and file of America, has been floundering for well over 30 years. They have not received a pay raise relative to inflation in well over 30 years, this in the face of great gains in productivity. And let's be honest here. We, the working class, are the ones that pay the taxes. The rich, they will not pay taxes. The poor cannot pay taxes. It's the middle class that pays the taxes and makes this country go. And so long as the middle class is collapsing on itself, the economy in general is unsustainable. What you're seeing here, the collapse of our government and these Medicaid and Medicare, you know, projects or whatever you want to call it, is simply a byproduct of a grander problem.
Eric, thank you for the call. I appreciate that. Pat, you want to make a quick point on the diminishing middle class or working class?
It just sounds like Eric's getting his talking points from the last Jesse Jackson column I read on this point. I mean, it's the same standard liberal mantra that you always hear about these issues, and it would require a little bit of time to get into them, and hopefully we'll be able to do that.
I think you're depreciating a very real point, which is that people in the middle feel that their real incomes are not rising. That's a serious issue. And
it's not true, and that's the problem. It's not true.
Well, I mean, real incomes are not rising. That is true, especially with the threat of inflation. You see rising gas and food prices. That's a real issue.
But not as a function of how people live versus how they lived 30 years ago.
We're going to pick up this very important point and talk about a whole bunch of other very important points in the next hour. In the first hour, I've had John McCarron from the Tribune, Charles Lipson from University of Chicago, Pat Hughes, former U.S. Senate candidate from Illinois, and your calls here on Beyond the Beltway. Join us in the next hour. Live from Chicago, this is Dan Proft sitting in for Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, you, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communication radio studio in Chicago's beautiful River North area. We are joined tonight by Democrat John McCarron, a contributing columnist at the Chicago Tribune and a lecturer at DePaul University in Chicago, Charles Lipson, a political science professor at the University of Chicago, and Pat Hughes, who ran in the Republican primary for the U.S. Senate here in Illinois last year. He is currently the vice president and general counsel at Ocean Atlantic Realty. Our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. And gentlemen, before the break, we had a caller from Texas who was talking about the vanishing middle class and the issue of, he didn't say this specifically, but I think it's an interesting issue. There's so much time spent talking about the unemployment rate, understandably so, talking about those on the lowest rungs of our society, understandably so. But there's a lot of middle-class folks who may have a job or may be a two-job family, may be paying their mortgage on time, but have real economic security concerns as they see particularly commodity prices rise, food and gas, inflationary pressures in the economy. And what do you see from either party that is addressing, and forget the ideological spectrum of Democrat, Republican, Independent, but the socioeconomic spectrum of who is going to be the party of the middle class in the 2012 cycle? Pat Hughes.
I think it should be the Republicans, because I think the message of the Republican Party, if it's given correctly, will attract the middle class voters. There's a lot of those Reagan Democrats that kind of went away from us in 2008. And it's in the sense that our economic policies, if effectuated correctly, are the ones that will work. We have to get government off the backs of the average worker. We have to lower taxes, not just at the federal level, but at the local level, at the property level. We have to give people choices about where to send their kids to school, give them money in order to do that. So there are a lot of ways that the Republicans articulate those issues that would be beneficial to the middle class. And the reason I was a little upset with the caller previously is because he was laying out what I view as the Democratic talking points, that it's the Republicans and free market thinking that's ruining our economic circumstances for the middle class. And I don't think that's the case. I think the Democrats have sold the middle class a bill of goods, and it's coming home to roost with the structural debt and deficits caused by a lot of the programs that are in place, by what's happened in private businesses with the debt and deficits owed to union employees, not just now, but long after they retire. And again, I use the word, it's unsustainable. So I think that game is up, and it's time for us to move forward. And I think the Republicans, if they give the message correctly, would be a better sell.
John McCarron.
Oh, those sounded like talking points to me, Pat. I don't know, but I guess I'll let fly with mine. I according to any data I've seen that I put any credibility into, real incomes in this country have been trending downward since the 70s. And if you're trying to say, well, yeah, but now we have cable TV and iPods and whatnot, that's true. There are a lot of things about life that have make it more pleasant now, perhaps, than before. But as Dan points out, the cost of the basics, gasoline and whatnot, are rising. But I think we're talking now about this is the real touchstone. This is why people are angry, because they don't think they're
children are going to do as well as they. And people are very angry. And I think politics in this country now and for the foreseeable future is going to be about where is the anger going to go and whom will it be directed. It reminds me a lot of the 30s in that regard. And as you remember, the 30s did not turn out well, either here or in Europe. And I guess what galls me a little bit is we seem to have a president now who, as I said earlier, is kind of a conciliator, and he doesn't want to use the anger weapon. Whereas the Republicans, I think, are using it very effectively.
Charles Lipson, your view on this?
I think that there's a real problem here, that real incomes in the middle sector, the middle income groups, have not been rising. It's hard to say whether they've been falling or just remaining steady because the problem that John raises, which is quality improvements. Our cars are better, our TVs are better, our phones are better, and so forth. But when the economy is growing broadly based at about 2% a year, every 30 to 35 years, basically your income doubles. And nobody thinks that we're twice as wealthy on average as we were in 1980. Right. So there's something that's happened, and it's not just happened in the United States. It's happened all across Europe. That suggests to me, and it's happened in Japan as well. So it suggests to me that there's something about advanced economies as we've moved away from manufacturing into high technology and information economies that needs to be addressed. Our schooling systems are not working very well. When you measure outputs, this is not just sort of week to week or year to year tests, but when you measure the vocabularies of second year college graduates now, they're really not any higher than 10th graders were in the year 1900. So we're now giving four more years of education without any real better outcomes. I think that there are four big issues that middle class people are now worrying about. They're worrying about job security, because everybody knows, except for those of us who are tenured professors, that you don't have job security. The second is, I think they're worried about schools for their children, whether those schools are really effective in preparing them for the future. They're worried about health care, because the rising costs of health care is biting into everything else. And not just at the individual level. When the university plans its budget each year, they have to think really hard about how much of all their increased revenues are going to pay simply for health care for all their employees. And the final thing is that I think people are really concerned about savings and retirement, and we haven't really been willing to address the problem that we design retirement systems to retire in the early to mid-60s when life expectancy was early to mid-60s. Now people are living well into their 80s, and we have a retirement system that simply is asking for fewer and fewer young people to pay for more and more retired people, and that's an unsustainable system.
Well, that's it, but then where's the give, right? Because everybody agrees that it's demographically evident that we're an aging population. Everybody understands that life expectancies are, you know, greater than they've ever been. And so
that's a good thing.
And it's a good thing, and something has to give. And this gets us right back to the conversation about Paul Ryan's path to prosperity and the larger discussion about Medicare and Medicaid. And also, too, although this isn't included in his plan, it's certainly a conversation piece, which is Social Security.
I would just add one thing. We're in a better situation than many of our competitor countries, because we're not in a population implosion. Italy is not reproducing itself. Yes. Japan is not reproducing itself. One reason there's been a lot of speculation why there wasn't a lot of looting in Japan, one is the cultural explanation. I think that carries a lot. But the other is that 70-year-old people don't loot.
Yeah,
we've got a lot of immigrants coming in, right, who want to work, and that really does give us some relief.
And as Mark Stein said about Japan, maybe instead of the Walkman, they should have invented the Walker. Talking about an old nation.
The governor of Wisconsin.
We're going to be back with more of your calls, 1-800-723-8289, here on Beyond the Beltway. Dan Prof sitting in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway with my distinguished panel tonight. Let's go right back to the phone lines. We're having this conversation about the vanishing middle class, the real fears that middle class families feel that, Charles, you outlined in the context of the larger issue of some of these entitlement programs that, frankly, a lot of middle class families have gotten very comfortable with. And while they can agree, they can kind of agree intellectually that changes need to be made, when the changes impact them, they draw a line. Let's go to David in Muncie, Indiana, listening on our flagship WLS. Hey, David.
I had both a comment and a question. And my comment was that some of your panelists suggested, like David Brooks and Mitch Daniels have, that for now the GOP should drop abortion as an issue. I think that's a bad idea. I tend to vote Republican for president, not because they're fiscal conservatives, but in spite of it. I'm pro-life because I believe in safeguarding the weak and helpless, and I'm an economic populist for the same reason. So if you take abortion out of the equation, I'll vote for the Democrat. And plus, long-term, it really isn't a losing issue, because unlike gay marriage, those 25 and under are moving in my direction. Now, my question is that the problem with entitlements seems to be that healthcare costs are rising faster than anything else that could possibly keep up with them. And one of the things that worried me about Obamacare was that Medicare is already seems to be underfunded, and he added an extra 15 million or so people to it. And people on Medicare already have a hard time finding doctors who will accept them. And I was just wondering if
people on Medicaid.
I'm sorry. You're right. I misspoke. I meant to say Medicaid. You're absolutely right. My fault. What I meant to say was that, he added 15 million people to Medicaid, and it's already having problems with it. There are people who can't find doctors who will take them. Although some people seem to think that may happen in the future with Medicare. And I was wondering, if doctors were required by law not to turn away people on Medicaid or Medicare, but had to treat them the same as people with private insurance, I was wondering if that could best bend the cost curve downward. And would it be legal to make a law like that?
Pat Hughes.
I don't know that it would be legal if you mandated them to take a particular patient or a particular coverage. I mean, I don't know all the issues on that. Would it bend the cost curve down? I don't know. I mean, in my view, you know, obviously I'm opposed to Obamacare. I think there were measures in the private sector that we could have taken to do that. You know, for example, we're not allowed to buy insurance across state lines. And I thought if you open that market up to all 50 states, it would add more competition and drive the cost down. For example, the state of California only has 6 insurance companies that sell health insurance in that entire state with that giant population. So if you did something like that, tort reform, ending fraud and abuse, you could lower the structural cost of health care down. And then as a consequence, that would open it to accessibility while at the same time protecting those folks that really do need to be covered in the safety net through Medicaid. I think that's a proposal that the Republicans had on the table in 2010, and it's one that the Democrats ignored, you know, basically shoved Obamacare down our throats, and now it's very unpopular, and we have, you know, additional problems because we have a government-run system in Medicare that's underfunded and unsustainable, and now we're adding to that. I don't know what gives folks the idea, hey, we've been doing this for 40 years and it doesn't work. Let's add a whole other segment to it that's also not going to work. I don't understand that logic.
Well, isn't it, John McCarron, isn't it true? I mean, the payroll taxes don't cover the cost of Medicare. Medicare is insolvent if you really did kind of honest bookkeeping. So what do we do from your perspective to live up to the promise of Medicare and Medicaid, at least as it was originally conceived, and still make it financially sustainable? Do we raise taxes?
Well, I like a couple of Pat's ideas. I like interstate insurance industry. There's also something called association health plans, which you're all probably familiar with, where, for instance, all the barbers could form an association if they're not in one already, or all the real estate agents or whatnot, and have an ERISA, if I can get a little wonky, covered health plan. You can't do that now, and you should be able to. One thing I find ironic talking about health care and politics, though, is ultimately the forces that are stopping some of these things from happening are in the case of association health plans, are the insurance companies. They really don't they don't want what they call self-insured insurance plans, because for the insurance company to take the risk, as they say in the business, it's much more lucrative than to just manage a health plan where the employer or the association is taking the risk. Anyway, it gets wonky, like I say. But here's another case where, you know, it's not the poor folks who are out there carrying the banner for spend. It's the, you know, the six-figure hospital administrators. It's big pharma. It's the doctors who write prescriptions to their own radiology labs that they happen to own.
But these
are people that usually are kind of like in a Republican kind of bracket.
Well,
just wait until they find out who's going to end up paying the piper if we make cuts to Medicare.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Did Big Pharma support Obamacare?
Some did, some didn't.
No, they almost basically Big Pharma and Big Insurance all supported it. There were none of those hairy ads, you know, whatever.
Because they were going to get guaranteed enrollees.
That's right. The argument that the Democrats made publicly was that the special interests were opposed to this, but that was wrong. All the special interests were bought off by Obamacare. The opposition was broadly public. David's comments, the caller, that we could simply require physicians, this comes close to price controls, and basically what we know is that price controls in the end don't work.
But isn't that what we have with Medicare and Medicaid to begin with?
Well, and what you see is that people are opting out, and he says, well, okay, then make it illegal to opt out. Well, then the next thing that happens is poor care.
Or black markets
and all sorts of other things. It seems to me that one of the things that was never addressed in any of this was supply. I wanted to see vast increases in the number of trained, high-quality nurses, especially nurse practitioners. Nothing was done about that. I think that I certainly agree with interstate competition on insurance. I wrote a column in the Tribune
about that.
It's
not true that nothing was done. There's a lot more money for medical education in Obamacare.
Well, I hope that I think that the supply side of it is very important, and
we're
it's not just
to promote family practitioners as opposed to everyone wanting to be a high-priced specialist.
And then I think finally, you need to give consumers some power to discipline in the market. And right now, it's essentially big insurance companies facing off against doctors. And it's a system that's very difficult for the small consumer to have any influence on at all.
Our toll-free number, again, 1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289, if you want to call in and join the conversation. We've got Chris from Palatine who wants to comment on Big Pharma. Chris.
Yes, gentlemen. You know, talking about cuts, you know, we just get back to cutting budgets and cutting expenses. I propose a very simple solution. Let government act like every other big business, starting like with Walmart, and use its power of the purse and use its power of demand to negotiate pricing, i.e. the pharmaceutical industries. Let's cut the huge subsidy to the pharmaceutical industry, allow the government to negotiate prices the same way the VA does, the same way every big business does, cut the price down. That'll save hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And then along the lines of cutting, here's a couple of little minor suggestions I have for cutting expenditures. Let's cut the ag subsidies that are going out primarily to these big corporations. You want to cut? Let's privatize the federal flood insurance program. Let's privatize all of the attempts to put Wi-Fi and cell phones into rural areas. If the marketplace isn't going to do it, it doesn't find it profitable.
Chris,
why should we be subsidizing people in rural areas?
Yeah, but Chris, let me ask you this question. This is often argued by the left, the idea the government's going to come in and negotiate prices. And when the government, quote unquote, negotiates, it's at the point of a gun, right? The government is not like a business enterprise because the government has a monopoly of force in society, and they're the only ones that do. So that is an impossibility that, you know, the government are negotiating with the private sector is, you know, an alligator negotiating with a duck.
Well, you know, life is a big city, and you look at how much money the government is pouring into basic research that benefits the pharmaceutical industry. And my feeling is if the pharmaceutical industry can sell a drug in Canada for a price, they should charge no more than that price in the United States. And if they want to make more money, then why are we subsidizing the world, which is what we are doing?
Chris, thanks. Chris, I appreciate the call and I appreciate your perspective. John, you wanted to to the defense of Canada?
I was going to say, I mean, things are much cheaper in Canada. I think if you looked at who's actually doing the basic research that for developing new drugs, a lot of it, if not most of it, is done by the government through National Institute of Health and whatnot.
Just a point of issue there. As I understand it, pharmaceutical companies to bring a drug to market, the R&D and the going through the FDA regulatory process is over $1 billion to bring every new drug to market that pharmaceutical companies bear. So I mean that's significant R&D expenditures that are done privately to bring new markets to bear. Right?
Is it a drug someone needs, or is it just maybe a buffered or altered a version of something that's already on the market? I mean, it's a complicated subject.
Is Viagra a need, or is it a kidding? Of course,
the Charles Lipson. Oh, it's a critical need.
thank you.
I know. I speak for only my fellow panelists. I think Chris is exactly right in saying that there are a lot of subsidies that are sort of everybody's got their hand in the government's pocket, and this needs to be a fairly thoroughgoing reform. It can't just be a reform that falls on the backs of the poor.
And on that note, we'll be back with more of your calls. Again, our toll-free number, 1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289. Dan Proff sitting in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway. Dan Proff sitting in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway. And let's get right back to the phone lines, talking about the Paul Ryan plan, entitlement reform, the lingering impacts of the Obamacare legislation and the corresponding debate. We've got Shendu in Houston, Texas, calling us from KLBJ. How are you?
Hi. Thank you for doing this show, first of all. And I have 2 points here, sir. I see that there are not many doctors available. Whenever I search for doctors in my area, I see the same doctor happening in different clinics. And I see that is one of the reasons why the price is going up, because we don't have enough doctors. And why is this? Like, I think somebody is controlling the number of doctors that the colleges put out every year. We need to concentrate on putting out more doctors out so that...
Oh, they're absolutely controlled. There are only a small number of schools that are accredited to put out doctors. It's incredibly expensive to train a doctor. We probably ought to train more of them, but we really ought to train a lot more nurses, and especially the more highly qualified end of the nursing spectrum, which are the nurse practitioners. One of the problems is that when you have bureaucracies that are set up to do this, they may receive a per capita reimbursement for a student. So you're a state university, you receive $10,000 for every new student. Well, which would you rather do? Teach 100 students in a big psychology class, or teach 10 students in a nursing class where you have to do hands-on? Well, it's a no-brainer if you're a college administrator. So you have to set up, and that's one of the problems with regulations, that you often end up defeating the very purposes. So I think you're exactly right, Chandu, that we need a lot more medical professionals, but I wouldn't just say doctors.
I'm sorry, Pat Hughes, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that the incentive to become a doctor has been reduced significantly from where it was, for example, 30 years ago when I used to go see my pediatrician. It's not as cost effective. It's very expensive. It's a huge commitment, schooling, loans, everything else. And then the payoff down the road.
Med mal insurance.
And the payoff down the road is not what it once was, both in money and in prestige.
We had some agreement on the panel about the idea that healthcare plans should be allowed to be sold across state lines. We've got a call on that. We've got John from Minier, Illinois, listening to us on WLS. Hey, John.
I think there needs to be a discussion as to really be able to defend the position that one sells across state lines. I've been in the insurance business for 40 years, mainly devoted to health insurance, and unfortunately I failed to see how we can defend the position of being able to sell across state lines. Does it any value? For example, the cost of health care in California is considerably different than the cost of health care, let's say, in central Illinois.
Well, that's certainly true, but it's also true that the cost of repairing a car in Mississippi is different than the cost of repairing a car in Illinois. So,
excuse me, I'm sorry. Yeah. What does that have to do with insurance? When the cost of insurance is the cost of your administration plus the cost of your claims, claims are driven by technology and inflation. That is the main part of that. That's the problem. Now, I'm an avid against the Obamacare program because it does nothing to attack cost of insurance. The cost of insurance, again, is technology and inflation. You do have administrative costs. The cost in California, the cost in Central Illinois, entirely different.
Well, but John,
I'm in the insurance. I'm in the insurance business. I have customers all over in multi-states. So, am I selling across state lines? Yes, I am. Are we subject to Illinois State Commissioner for certain issues? Yes, we are. For others, we are not due to ERISA programs.
And I
would like for somebody to be able to really dig into the issue, how can you defend being able to sell across state lines being of value?
Well, John, let me ask you a question since you've been in the business for 40 years, as you said,
and
you sell insurance in different states.
Are
there not significant differences in the mandates that individual states put on the health care plans that can be sold within their states, and does that at all drive the cost of insurance?
The mandates are a very small portion. They are things that do drive costs. There's no question about that. But you have to look at the percentages. The percentages of the mandates being a factor compared to the whole system of health care costs is very minor. When you stop and think about it, it just mandates for this or mandates from some of these issues, yes, they are important to some of the people. Yes, they might drive up the cost a percent or two. But when you have the cost that we have now ranging anywhere from 8 to 10 to 12% and possibly even more, then you have an issue. In fact, you'd even address another issue that kind of comes into the cost of insurance, that if you put a group of barbers together, let's say, and you call that an association, the cost of the association program is nothing but the cost that the barbers incur. If the barbers happen to be a group of employees and members that have more claims than the average, the cost of the barbers' insurance will be greater than the cost of, let's say, bankers or this type of thing. So really, we're back to the real issue when it gets down to cutting costs. It really isn't across state lines. I don't think we can defend that. It really isn't association groups, because even small groups are part of a bigger group, because when they're underwritten and put together, you're doing the same thing.
John, I'm
very, very disappointed in the approach that these two issues, association groups and selling across state lines, doesn't do us any good.
John, I appreciate the call. Thank you for your contribution. John McCarron.
I haven't heard anyone at this panel say you couldn't have experience-based premiums, so I'm not sure why if the loss experience in Florida or California was worse than that of beautiful South Carolina, that you wouldn't allow for better premiums and lower premiums in South Carolina. Let me add this. I think the greatest hope for controlling the costs of Medicare, Medicaid, anything, is to have scientific panels. Yes, they might be government sponsored, Dan, or they might be professionally sponsored, that would decide on the efficacy, you know, whether stuff works. And because there's a lot of stuff out there that gets invented, put it on the market, and the insurance has to pay for it, and it either doesn't work or it's marginal, or we're giving hip replacements to people over 80 years old, or, you know, some people have to make some decisions there. And when you have a political party that turns around and says that those are death panels, I'm talking, I guess, mainly about Sarah Palin, then that really erodes the argument. But efficacy,
would you prevent me, if I'm over 80 years old and I want to buy insurance that covers my ability?
No, I would not.
Okay.
Whatever you want to pay for it, you can have it. It's a free country.
Okay. More agreement? Charles Lipson, you want to add something?
I think that the basic point, there's no panacea about cross state lines. There's no panacea about any of these partial fixes. I think what people are saying is wherever you can get rid of monopoly pricing power and allow competition, that's going to be a good thing. And if you want a clear example of it, the one medical procedure that has really substantially come down in price over the years is LASIK eye surgery. And boy, you'd think if there's anything I don't want to be price sensitive about, it's somebody playing around with my eyeball. But the fact is,
or your Viagra.
Well, yeah, I don't want to go there. The fact is, prices of LASIK eye surgery have come down, and the reason is people pay for it out of their pocket, and competition has driven it down. I'm not saying people need to pay for everything out of their pocket. I'm just saying that where you have competition, it does put restraints on price.
And I want to pick up on this principle of competition and another space that was making news this week. It was kind of drowned out by what happened with the potential government shutdown. The various wars we're in the Middle East and other issues, but it's nonetheless important. And Charles, you referenced this in the first hour in terms of at the K-12 level or even pre-K-12 level, we're not getting the job done in this country. The Supreme Court weighed in with another very important decision in the area of school choice with respect to an Arizona law that would allow individuals to contribute money, that would give an individual tax credit for contributing money to a private school. So for an individual, up to $500, you get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit. For a couple, it would be $1,000. And this came a week after the state of Indiana expanded its school choice program up to households of $60,000. So it's not just for those below the poverty line anymore. This is becoming a competition to extend to the middle class who may not otherwise be able to afford choice. And
the D.C.
And the D.C. school, the D.C. scholarship vote, which the House Republicans passed after the Obama administration was going to redline that out of existence, but not without some opposition from some Republicans who are tethered to the teachers' unions, just as the Democrats are as a party. Where do you see the school choice issue going as it gains more popularity, as particularly urban school systems don't seem to be getting the job done? And is increased competition at the K-12 level part, at least, of the answer with respect to improving the quality of educational outputs we're getting at the primary and secondary grades?
I think it's a critical issue. I think it's a critical issue in urban areas. I think it's a critical issue actually almost everywhere. And it's being driven by the fact that two things. One is outcomes have been bad, and two, the economy that we're all moving into going forward is increasingly education-based, knowledge-based. So it's not even a matter of you finish college and then you're done being educated. Many professions that we have now, you have to get continuing education credits, and even if they don't call them that, if you're working in a Ford factory, you really do a lot of education to keep up with what it is. But I don't think it's fair. I think it's right to say that the unions have been an adult work program, and I would also say that big school bureaucracies have been an adult work program, and schools haven't been oriented to children. But I've got to say, the problem is not simply who's teaching and how much money is not going into classrooms. The fact is, we've got a breakdown of family structure where kids are not coming to school ready to learn. They're coming in at 5 years old from broken families. The kids have never been read to, and they watch TV. Their parents are never reading them a book. So it's not simply a matter that can be cured even by a good teacher.
We're going to pick this issue up of K-12 reform and school choice as it's advancing in other states, and with the important Supreme Court decision I referenced on the Arizona tax credit law. Take your calls at 1-800-723-8289 on Beyond the Beltway. Dan Proft back with you, sitting in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway with my distinguished panel, and we are discussing school reform at the K-12 level as part of the larger issue of American competitiveness and our standing in the world, not getting the job done at the K-12. I think there's general agreement on that. So what should be done? Many states, Indiana expanding their school choice program. I think there's 14 states that run about 24 different school choice programs. Congressional Republicans voting to reauthorize the D.C. Opportunity Scholarship Program, and an important Supreme Court case upholding an Arizona tax credit law that would be a boon for private schools in particular. We hear from Charles Lipson, Pat Hughes. I want to get you in on this conversation about K-12 reform and what it should look like and its import.
Well, it certainly should include vouchers, not just for private schools, but for private parochial schools as well. I think the arguments regarding the Establishment Clause are misplaced. And so I support the Arizona law and think it's a good place for the tax credit to go. With respect to the D.C. law, I just would like to make a point. I'm disappointed, as I know you are, Dan, with how some of our Republican congresspeople here in Illinois voted for that. Bob Dole, Judy Biggert, Tim Johnson all voted to oppose that system and oppose the vouchers there. Extraordinarily disappointing. And, you know, my general feeling about this is, you know, you've got to take the hold that the bureaucracy, including the teachers union, has on the educating of our children. I made the point in the break that, you know, it costs so much less in a private school. My kids go to a private Catholic school in the suburbs, and it costs so much less to educate them there than it does in the public school. And I know there's some structural reasons for that, but not all. And I think it has to do with the fact that, you know, the teachers' unions, and I know that's a hot topic now, has a structural tie-in on the cost of education. And then there's just too much bureaucracy. And the only way to do that is to insert competition in the system, and vouchers is a great way to do that. So I'm supportive.
John McCarron.
I prefer the charter model, or the Chicago model, I guess, as Barack Obama and Arnie Duncan would promote, because it keeps public money in a public system. In other words, these are public schools, but because they have their own charters, they're allowed to not have to abide by union rules. And the other point I wanted to make is that the public schools end up taking all the kids that the Catholic parochial and private schools don't want, or who have behavioral issues, or you know, get kicked out of charter schools. So I mean, they're having to deal with a tougher clientele. And I agree. I think the teachers unions and and especially places, big cities like Chicago, where you find out that the reason we don't have recess anymore is so the teachers can go home a little earlier in the afternoon. I mean, that really frosts me as a liberal Democrat. So I don't want to be put in the position where I have to defend teachers unions or trial lawyers.
It's good to categorize them together. I like that. Charles Lipson.
I would just say that in general, just stepping back from even the big issue of schools, as we cut back and we on federal expenditures and state and local expenditures under equal pressure, we really need to take a hard look, not just at efficiency of programs, but priority of programs. And in particular, I'm very concerned about cuts that will fall on the weakest and the most vulnerable, the people who special needs kids, for example, in schools, or the mentally ill and services for them. I mean, my goodness, if we really just can't, we really have to, as people of, as voters and as citizens, we really have to make sure that as we cut back, we don't allow this sword to fall on people who are the weakest. And the second point related to that is I think we really need to focus on core government activities. For example, one of the biggest problems related to Chicago schools is the tremendous insecurity, not within the schools. The schools are almost like prisons now. You go in through – it's like getting on an airplane. You have to go through metal detectors and all the rest. But getting to and from school is a dangerous thing. And I think that police, fire, services for the mentally ill, and all of those need to be our priorities as we cut back.
But isn't K through 12 education similar to Medicare and Medicaid in the sense that we initiated these huge social engineering programs generations ago? And nobody's given them a second thought since. We talk about how much more money we are or not going to pour into it, when in fact they're structurally incapable of producing what they promised to produce.
There's been a big problem, and the biggest problem is we've virtually doubled the amount of money that we're spending on K-12 over the last 25 years. We're not getting better outcomes. The second problem related to that is that when I went to school, when John went to school, and probably when you, Dan, and Pat went to school, most of the money was coming locally, and almost all the rules were set locally, subject to constraints like federal laws on non-discrimination and so forth. But now There's so much that's being set by the federal level, and I think that that happened almost without a thought about how that happened.
Yeah, but let me suggest that that there's something more at play, even at the local level, with teachers' unions in particular, and you know, their own power centers in every urban center. I mean, first of all, just to for some baseline here in terms of the how critical this problem is, 18 of our 50 most populous cities in this country have high school graduation rates under 50%. 18 of our 50 most populous cities. I mean, that is, you want to talk about demography and you want to talk about how much we're spending or how much we're taxing. That should frighten everybody in terms of what that portends for the future of this country.
Absolutely.
But the teachers unions in Chicago, for example, I know, despite what we've known for 40 years, the majority of schools, foreign languages are taught at the high school level, not at the grade school level. That's a local curriculum decision. But why don't they make that change despite what we know about how children learn foreign languages? Well, because we've always done it this way. So we're always going to do it this way because it's a structural issue. These systems are set up as jobs programs for adults, as you said.
Jobs.
The entire thing is for the benefit and the convenience of the adults. They're not set up to educate kids, so you know what? They don't.
And we're dealing with broke kids from broken families.
But you can't educate a two-parent loving family. You can't educate opportunity, or you can't legislate opportunity, as we have seen from kids with, you know, come from some very tough backgrounds who go on to do great, wonderful things. Unfortunately, that's going to have to be the last word, and I get it, since I'm the guest host. It's been fun filling in for Bruce Dumont while he was hanging out with his Hollywood friends. He'll be back next week. I want to thank John McCarron from the Chicago Tribune at DePaul University, Charles Lipson from University of Chicago, and former U.S. Senate candidate Pat Hughes for joining me. This has been Beyond the Beltway. And I also should quickly thank, before I go, to amateur Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman helped make this radio program possible. Produced and associate with WLS Talk Radio and Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Thank you very much.